as he leads us in his second part in his consideration of Elijah.
I don't know about you guys, but I can sort of identify with Elisha a little bit, being a bald-headed man. And I suppose if those kids had probably done that to me, I'd be pretty upset too. So what we want to look at tonight is Elijah and really his relationship with Elisha. You know, there's that quote in the Proverbs that says, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. And that's, I think, really what Elijah and Elisha was, their relationship was really like. Elijah, before he met Elisha, was one of those really, what would you say, abrupt, harsh, judgmental sort of people. Whereas when he met Elijah, Elisha, there's a bit of a change, isn't there, between that character that he had before and the character that he has after you see him with Elijah. Kind of me. So if we have a look at sort of the overarching things that we're going to look at tonight, I know there's a little bit of a delay there, so we'll maybe not wait for it to come up, but you can read it when it comes up. Basically, the first thing that we want to think that God used to turn him around. So that's the first thing that we want to look at tonight, throw it back into the land when Jesus returns. So that's really the two overarching areas that we want to look at tonight. So we'll just start by looking at the first one. So friendship was ultimately the tool that God used to change Elijah around, or to turn him around, put him into that situation, and he'd be going through a fairly decent trial there. You know, he hasn't got any food. He's watching the water, the little water that he's got, just dry up. And he'd see the only provisions that he's been given, ones from God. And that was, he needed to learn that idea of God manifestation in caring for others like God was caring for him. And he was able to do that. He learned that lesson in going to the widow of Zarephath. And what's interesting is he learned it with her, but he didn't learn it with his own brothers and sisters in Israel. So he was able to show it to others, but not to his brothers and sisters so much. The other thing that God did is he confronted Elijah with the facts. Remember when Obadiah came out of the cave, he said, look, I've saved 50 prophets, two times 50 prophets in the cave. And yet Elijah's there later on saying, I only am left a prophet of Yahweh. So it's almost like God is saying, hang on, Elijah, just wait a minute. You're not the only one left. And he's showing him this time and again to just confront him with the facts. You look at where God took him at Horeb and what we had to look at last time. And he's getting Elijah to see things in a very different way. So what are you doing here, Elijah? He says, you've got to make that connection. This is not what I'm about. But he wasn't able to make that connection. And so Elijah, in that situation, he says, after the wind and the earthquake and the fire, and they take your office away from you. And we'll pick it up a bit. But he gave Elisha the office, but he didn't want to do it, I don't think. You can see that as we go through the next part of the chapter. But the way that God turned Elijah around is actually in sending him a friend and just showing him different ways of approaching situations. And that's the way that I think Elijah changed. Because before that, he's this harsh and judgmental guy. What I'm going to do is we're going to pick it up in 1 Kings chapter 19. Verse 14 will do. So remember when... And then Yahweh said to him, go, return on the way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you come, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And verse 16, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And here's where it'll be a bit of a slap in the face to him. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room. So there you go. He's lost his office. He's been stripped of the office that he's had. And he was wrong. That's a bit of a slap in the face to him. He was wrong. And he was confronted with that. And so what happens is Elijah is, I think, a bit dirty that that's happened. So in verse 19, he actually goes and he does what God says and he gives Elisha the office, he's going to lead into that. But look how he does it in verse 19. So he departed thence from Horeb and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, in verse 19, who was ploughing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he with the 12th. And Elijah passed him by and cast his mantle on him. So you've got this scene here with Elijah walking up, probably in a bad mood, to Elisha, who has no idea what's going on, throws his coat over him, and then just keeps on going. And it's a busy scene here. Just think about what's going on there. You picture it. Elisha's out there in the field with his workmen. He's orchestrating all the events in the field. The rains have just come, and so it's pretty important that he gets out there straight away and he starts ploughing that field. There hasn't been a crop in 3.5 years, and so he needs to get the seed into the ground right now. So Elisha's going to be pretty busy, and I think probably pretty stressed as well, just trying to make this thing all happen. The fact that he's with the 12th oxen shows that he's probably the boss. By the way, the fact that there's 12 oxen shows that he's a pretty wealthy guy. This is 12 after a drought, and oxen were pretty expensive things. It's like a car, so it's like he's got 12 cars after a drought, after 3.5 years of basically nothing. And up comes Elijah and just unceremoniously just chucks his coat on him and onto Elisha, and he just keeps on walking. He's got a bit of attitude, doesn't he? And he did. It was very begrudging, I think, of Elisha. Elijah knew that he needed to do it, but I don't think internally he'd made that connection between what God was wanting him to be. He was doing the right thing, but his being needed improvement. In fact, he doesn't even say anything to Elisha. Look in verse 20. He just walks up, just chucks his mantle on him, and then Elisha is left. He left the oxen, ran after Elijah and said, "Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and mother and go there and go and I'll follow thee." And then the first thing that Elijah says to him is, "Go back again, for what have I done to you?" In other words, some translations say it like this. They say, "Go back, I've done my bit. What do I care what you do?" So it's quite a bizarre thing. So Elijah is a pretty attitudinal guy at the moment. Been stripped of his office, unceremoniously just chucks his coat over Elisha and keeps on walking down the road, and then says, "I don't care what you do. I've done my bit." That was Elijah's response to what God had asked him to do. And he's going to make sure that everyone knows that he doesn't like it. Elijah had to change, but at that point he hadn't. What's good is that God recognizes that. And he gives Elijah time. He gives Elijah the example of Elisha on which to model his own life. And that's pretty special, I reckon. So Elijah knew logically, I think, that he needed to do something, but he wasn't really able to do it just yet because I don't think he'd really taken it on board. He needed to look at Elisha. And see that's the way that he needed to go. Now, if you have a look on the screen in a minute, there's a really interesting quote because these events are actually cool. All right. Sorry, I was just talking to Ben, everyone. That quote that we've got there is a very, very interesting one because it's a reference, I think, directly to these passages here in 2 Kings. And we'll get to that in a minute. But just have a look at what Elisha is actually doing here. In verse 21, Elisha says, and he returned back from him. He took the yoke of oxen and slew them and boiled their flesh with instruments of the oxen and gave to the people, and they did eat. And he arose and went after Elijah and ministered to him. That, I think, is really interesting. This is no small thing. That's a lot of money. As we were saying before, that's like 12 cars that he's sacrificed. And he says goodbye to his family, has one last meal with them, and then he moves on. Now, the question, I suppose, for Elisha is what he's doing going to be out of alignment with what Jesus says in Luke chapter 9. So what we might do is we might go over to Luke chapter 9 and we'll just have a quick look at what Jesus says. So Luke 9 and verse 52. So this is when the 70 are sent out. Verse 51. And it came to pass when the time was that he should be received up to heaven, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered the village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. This is not when the 70 were sent out, sorry. And they didn't receive him because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elijah did? So we're in the context here of Elijah. Not necessarily this chapter at the moment. This is probably the chapter before. But he turned and rebuked them and said, you know not what manner of spirit you are, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And that is the change that Elijah needed to have. He needed to move from that destroy mentality towards this saving mentality. And that's what we can see sort of juxtaposed next to each other is in that one verse there in verse 56 is Elijah in destroy and Elisha in save. And then they go to another village. This is where it's interesting because this is our reference here. And it came to pass as they went in the way, a certain man said unto him, Lord, I'll follow thee wherever you go. And Jesus said unto him, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And he said to another, follow me. But he said, Lord, suffer me first to go and bury my father. It's almost like Elisha saying, oh, let me go and say goodbye to my parents. Jesus said to him, let the dead bury their dead, but go thou and preach the kingdom of God. And another also said, Lord, I'll follow you wherever. But let me first go and bid them farewell, which are at my house, again, just like Elisha. And Jesus said, no man, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. So a bit of a question for you, and you don't have to answer this on the text or anything like that, but just have a think about it. Was Elisha out of step with what Jesus was saying there in Luke chapter 9, no man having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God, because that's exactly what Elisha was doing. Here's the difference. When Jesus is talking about people going back, he's talking about people that aren't willing to make 100% commitment. He says, oh, they'll say they'll follow, but they also really want to get the benefits of not fully leaving everything behind. They still want some of their old way of life. They're not really 100% committed to the truth. But what Jesus is doing here is he's talking about people who have volunteered their service, but they want to put it off. He said, oh, look, I will follow you, but just let me go and do some other things first. Jesus says, no, once you put your hand to the plow, you can't expect your flexi time, you can't expect your 35-hour weeks or your holidays or your 3 months maternity leave. You can't expect all the benefits of your old life because it's not an option. If you're going to put your hand to the plow, you cannot look back, and that's exactly what Elisha did. Just look at what he does in 1 Kings 21. He leaves his ox, he leaves his career, he sacrifices the bullock or the oxen, He gets rid of his career, he totally cuts it off. Not only that, he uses the plow to cook the meal. He's done away with it. There's no going back. He's saying goodbye to his parents, and then he has made that cut. He's completely cut off his former way of life. And that is an example to Elijah about making an immediate change. Elijah's been given chance after chance after chance after chance and just hasn't taken it on board, hasn't changed. But here's Elisha straight away, as soon as he heard from Elijah that he's going to be prophet in Elijah's stead, that's it. He's on his way. He's moving straight away. And we don't actually read anything else about Elijah and Elisha after this until we get to 2 Kings chapter 2. 2 Kings chapter 2, we might as well go there, is just a couple of pages on. All right, I'm just going to have to find it on my computer, sorry. Okay, 2 Kings chapter 2. We'll go and we'll pick it up at verse 1. And it came to pass, when the Lord would take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. And Elijah said unto Elisha, tarry here, I pray thee, for the Lord has sent me to Bethel. And Elisha said unto him, as the Lord lives, and as thy soul lives, I will not leave thee. So they went down to Bethel, both of them. And the sons of the prophets that were at Bethel came forth to Elisha and said unto him, knowest thou not that the Lord will take away thy mask from thy head today? And he said, yea, I know it, hold your peace. And Elijah said unto him, Elisha, tarry here, I pray thee, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho. And he said, as the Lord lives and as thy soul lives, I will not leave thee. So they came to Jericho. And the sons of the prophets that were at Jericho came to Elisha and said unto him, knowest thou that the Lord will take away thy mask from thy head today? And he answered, yea, I know it. Hold your peace. And Elijah said, tarry here, I pray thee, for the Lord has sent me to Jordan. And he said, as the Lord lives and as thy soul lives, I will not leave thee. And they too went on. So you can look at this just from a surface level. And you can see straight away, this is a different Elijah. This is not the harsh and judgmental man that he was. This is someone that's actually got a pretty good relationship with another person. And their relationship's grown to the point where they're actually pretty close, a very close relationship. And you just think about this for a second. If you were in Elijah's shoes, how would you feel? If you had a vision from God that you're going to be taken away, you don't know how, you don't know exactly what's going to happen, it's a bit daunting, really. And if you're anything like me, you'd probably be a bit afraid. In fact, it's probably a bit of a trial that you'd be going through. And I think that's what Elijah was going through. He doesn't know what's going to happen. That's the huge, huge unknown. I mean, we're looking at what the unknown is for us at the moment with all this coronavirus stuff. We just don't know. And you think about the anxiety that, you know, all of society is feeling. We just don't know what the next day is going to bring or the next hour is going to bring. It's huge. And here's Elijah with a message from God saying, I'm going to take you away. That'd be pretty daunting. Yeah, he's got faith, but there's still that unknown. I think that would be pretty intense. And fearing, you know, fearful, you'd be very fearful. In fact, Elijah has a tendency to fear the unknown. I think that's why in verse 15 it says, fear not. Not only that, when Elijah goes through trial, he tends to be a bit of a recluse, doesn't he? Remember in 1 Kings 19, when he goes down to the Horeb, he left his servant at Beersheba because he was in the depths of depression at the time. And that's what we find here. He doesn't want anyone near him. He says, Elisha, just stay here. I want to be by myself. Because that's what he does. That's the way Elijah works. He goes into his hole. Think, well, what happened the last time that happened at Beersheba? It's a negative response. I'm the only one that's left. That's what he said. I'm it. God knows that, And so he helps Elijah through by giving him his friend. And his friend didn't leave him. Gave him his best friend so that he could help him through the tough times that he was going to go through. And Elisha's there. He's able to comfort him. But not only that, God gives him the sons of the prophets. And he shows them the same vision so that they can also comfort Elijah and be there with him and for him in his time of need. But it goes deeper than that. God tells Elijah to go to all these different centers around the nation before he departs. And you think, well, where does he go? He goes to the traditional places of idol worship. You think, well, why? And so actually, this is an encouragement to Elijah. Think of Bethel. This is where Jeroboam had the whole golden calf. This is where people would go. This is a big place. But what's Elijah find there? He actually finds an ecclesia. He finds the sons of the prophets. And it's well and truly running. And there's no persecution. So you think about how far the nation's come in the last 10 or so years. It's like Elijah's being shown the greatness of God and the work that God's accomplished through him and through Elijah. And the nation's come so far. That'd be very encouraging for Elijah to see. Not only that, you've got the next one is Jericho. Remember Hiel the Bethelite? He actually rebuilt Jericho when he wasn't supposed to. Lost his two kids for it. That was another center of apostasy. What's he find there? A thriving ecclesia. So Elijah's told to go to these centers of apostasy that are no longer centers of apostasy, but they're strongholds of the truth. And so by God telling Elijah to go to those places, I actually think he's comforting Elijah and letting him know the work that he started in Israel has been profitable and that he should be strengthened by that. And because God's not going to deal unkindly with him. This is the other thing. Not only does God care for Elijah, but so too does Elisha. Just have a look at how Elisha actually comforts Elijah and helps him through the trial. This phrase, "I will not leave thee," is used pretty sparingly in the Bible, actually. But it's used in really, really interesting places. It's used here, obviously, in 2 Kings, but it's also used in Genesis 28, verse 10 through to 20. That's the phrase that It's first used when Jacob finds himself at Bethel at the time when he had the vision of the angels ascending and descending on that ladder going up into heaven. And it was at that point that the promises were given. And it's at that point that God says to Jacob, "I'll never leave you." Same place. The next time it's used is with Joshua. When Israel were about to cross the Jordan and enter the land. In fact, they can see Jericho. Where did they enter the land? Well, at the exact same place that Elijah's going to leave. So I think that's a really quite fascinating one. The other time it's used is in Jeremiah 46, where it's talking about Israel going through persecution. And there's actually no persecution now. And God's saying to him, "I'm not going to leave you, Elijah." And I think that would actually be a real encouragement to him. It's like this bit of a double whammy. God's guiding him to these places where all those worthies of old were told that God won't leave him. And it's at that same spot that Elisha's telling Elijah exactly the same thing. "I'm not going to leave you." Here's Elisha helping his friend, his brother, through the trials that he's going through. The subtle difference, I suppose, is that when in Genesis and Joshua and Jeremiah, it says God will never leave us, whereas Elisha was saying, "I won't leave you." So there's a subtle difference there, and I think that's an important difference to make because God will never leave us. So we'll move on to verse 7. So once that's happened and Elijah's going through all of this and Elisha's helping him through it, verse 7, 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood to view afar off, and they too stood by Jordan. Elijah and Elisha stood by Jordan. They too The two friends. In fact, that's verse 6 as well. They too went on. They too stood by the Jordan. Now it's like 10 years ago. Well, sorry, unlike 10 years ago. What's interesting is these sons of the prophets, this is how much Elijah's changed. Elijah sees these prophets as actually prophets. There's no mention of I have an Ionium left. He knows that the truth has taken hold in Israel. And they too went over on dry ground. Elijah took his mantle and wrapped it together and smote the waters, and they were divided hither and thither, so that they too went over on dry ground. That's pretty important. We're going to come back to that shortly, but just keep that going across in dry or on dry ground, just at the back of your mind for a minute. Verse 9. And when they were come over, Elijah said to Elijah, "Ask what I shall do for thee before I be taken away." And Elisha said, "I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me." And he said, "You've asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I'm taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee. But if not, it shall not be so." Now that would have even been more encouragement. So Elisha saw himself as a bit of the firstborn of Elijah in terms of the prophetic work. And that's what the double portion relates to. It's under the law. The firstborn was given certain privileges. One of those was a double portion. They got a double portion of the father's possessions. The firstborn was also set apart as specially devoted to God. They were held sort of next in honor to their parents. They actually acted as the priest for the family. So this is a very privileged position that Elisha actually sees, and Elijah sees. Very privileged position. And Elijah knowing that Elisha would be encouraged again, sorry, and Elijah knowing Elisha would be encouraged again by Elisha asking for this, because it shows to Elijah that the work he started isn't going to finish with his departure, because he knows it's going to go on. I think that will be an encouragement as well. So these two men, these two friends, have a great love for one another. They too. It just highlights, at least it highlights to me, I don't know about you, but it highlights just how far Elijah's come in the last 10 or so years that he's been with Elisha. And God worked with him with that. He worked with him to bring him into the kingdom. So much that the relationship between Elijah and Elisha was extremely close. So that when Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind, verse 11, it came to pass that as they still went on and talked, that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted them both asunder. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And when Elisha saw it, he cried, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. And he saw him no more. That was it. The relationship between these two men was extremely, extremely close. So close that those exact same words, when Elisha is on his deathbed, were repeated by the king. Said, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. So Elisha, not only did Elijah learn from Elisha, but Elisha also learned from Elijah. And so there's a really good bond there between them. So that's where we want to sort of leave that first part of our consideration tonight. What we want to do is we want to go back and just have a quick look at a few details, because this isn't where Elijah's work ends. Now we're actually going to run out of time very quickly, actually. So we'll go through this a little bit quick. We just want to highlight a few things about Elijah's mission in the future. So we're probably going to have to assume a little bit of knowledge with this, but that's okay. We just want to go back just a fraction to when Elijah was leaving. So when Elijah was leaving, sorry, when Israel entered the land, sorry, when Israel entered the land, they came across the Jordan. They went to Jericho first, and we know that. And then the next place they go is Bethel. And from Bethel, they go all over the place. They did the various military campaigns under Joshua. Now, how did Israel enter the land? They entered the land with the waters being parted, didn't they? How did Elijah leave? Well, they were at Gilgal to start off with. Then God says, go to Bethel. And then he says to Jericho. And then he goes across the Jordan. It's the exact opposite of the way that Israel entered the land. And that is actually really interesting. Because Elijah's work is going to finish at the exact same place that he left. And that's why I think Israel went out, crossed over dry shod, and Elijah left dry shod over the Jordan. Because when they go back under Elijah, they're actually going to go through water. And it's going to be a very, very interesting water, which we'll have a look at in a minute. So we'll just keep that in the back of your mind at the moment. Now, the next time we see Elijah is at the Mount of Transfiguration. And of course, we know the Mount of Transfiguration. That's where Elijah and Moses appeared to Jesus to strengthen him. But while there's definitely the reference of the law and the prophets, and Jesus being greater than the law and the prophets, there's also reference to Jesus' decease. And that's, of course, as we know, is the word Exodus. You think, well, what's that got to do with anything? Well, Moses led an Exodus out of Egypt and brought Israel into the land. Elijah is also going to lead an Exodus, but it's of the Jews around the world and bringing them back into the land when Jesus has returned. And it's that word Exodus that I think is really important, because they were strengthening Jesus for his Exodus in leading many sons to glory. And it's from that point on that Jesus actually talks about his own Exodus, I suppose, his own decease, as it were. But before we go into all of this, let's just go to Malachi chapter 4, because that's where we pick up Elijah's work in the future. Malachi 4, and we'll go verse 5. Behold, I'll send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. So whenever we see the day of the Lord, it's talking about great days of judgment. There's a few different ones in Scripture, but this one is referring to Armageddon. So Elijah will come before Armageddon. And what's he going to do? He's going to turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. So what he's going to do is to change people's minds, change their hearts, the hearts of Israel. He's going to change the hearts of Israel to be more like the hearts of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that is the purpose of what Elijah is going to do. And he's going to gather people from all around the world. Now, when Elijah goes out and regathers the Jews, he doesn't bring them straight back into the land. So they go out and he'll bring them all back, but they don't go straight back into the land. So people don't just start coming back in dribs and drabs. They actually come as a whole group. When in the prophetic scriptures, when it's talking about Israel and Judah, Judah is a reference to the Jews that are in the land when Jesus returns, whereas Israel or Ephraim and Jacob, sometimes it's referred to, is a reference to the Jews that are outside the land. So Elijah's work specifically here is in relation to the Jews that are outside the land. So he's gone out, he will go out and gather those people back into one place. But that's not going to be into Israel straight away. They're going to go somewhere. And if we go over to Ezekiel chapter 20, and there's a reference there on the screen, but Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 34, we can actually see what this is talking about, where this place is. Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 34. As I live, verse 33, says the Lord God, surely with a mighty hand and a stretched out arm, with fury poured out, will I rule over you. And I will bring you out from the people, and I will gather you out from all countries wherein you're scattered. With a mighty hand, with a stretched out arm, with fury poured out, and I'll bring you into the wilderness of the people. And there will I plead with you face to face, like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt. So will I plead with you. And I'll cause you to pass under the rod, and I'll bring you into the bonds of the covenant. That's what Elijah is going to be involved in doing, in bringing Israel back into the land. But they're brought into this place called the wilderness of the peoples. You think, well, where is this? Where is this wilderness of the peoples? I'll bring you into the wilderness of the people. We know from Jeremiah chapter 3, in the same context of these prophetic scriptures, that it's called the land of the north. So it's got to be north of Israel somewhere. We also know from Revelation chapter 17, where it talks about a woman riding a beast in a wilderness. And it says that this wilderness is filled with peoples and nations and tongues. So it's likely that the wilderness of the peoples that Elijah is going to take people to is somewhere in the region of Central Europe. But that's not our only proof to show that that's probably where it is. We've also got some other passages. Isaiah chapter 11, for instance, which gives us a lot more detail. So we can actually, well, might as well go to Isaiah 11, which shows us the way that Israel is actually going to come back into the land. The detail with this is actually quite remarkable, to be honest. So verse 10, Isaiah 11, verse 10. So I've got a kingdom context here. And in that day, there'll be a root of Jesse, which will stand for an ensign of the peoples, and to it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And it'll come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand a second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from all these different places. He'll set up an ensign for the nations, and people shall, they'll assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And the same idea, by the way, is actually picked up in Isaiah 27. But verse 11, that's our context, isn't it? God bringing Israel back into the land. But how's he going to do it? Verse 15, the Lord shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and with his mighty wind he'll shake his hands over the river. And that river, that's a reference to, not to the Nile, but to the Euphrates, because it will smite it in the seven streams. And again, interesting, make men to go over dry shod. So what's actually going to happen? He's going to shake his hand over the great river, which is the river Euphrates, and smite the tongue of the Egyptian sea down here. So we can see they're going to have to come through this way, and they're going to have to go over this way, over the top of Italy, through Spain, over the Rock of Gibraltar, and then over the top of Africa, and over the tongue of the Egyptian sea, whoops, and over to this part just here. But we actually get more details. So we go to the next verse, and there'll be a highway for the remnant of his people which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that they came up out of the land of Egypt. So this highway is going to be for the remnant that are left. So out of the wilderness of the peoples, when God goes through them with Elijah there and the rebels are cast out, those that are left come over those two routes and they come to Assyria and they take this highway back to the land. But where does that highway actually go? Well, we actually get a bit more information because we're looking at this point here. That is, where's my mouse gone? That is the top of the Red Sea, sorry, the Dead Sea just there. And that's the Jordan River, and Sea of Galilee is going to be further up. We actually know where they're going to come to exactly, the exact spot where Elijah is going to take them back into the land, because Hosea chapter 2 talks about this valley of Achor being a door of hope. Now, the valley of Achor, if you think about where that is where Achan's bones were thrown after his apostasy. Achan was in Jericho. Jericho is right there. The valley of Achor has to be either up here or over here or over here or over here. It's got to be around here somewhere. So of all the places that Israel are taken back, it just so happens to be right where Elijah left from. They crossed dry shod to go into the land, which was, we know that was a type of baptism. But when Elijah left, he crossed dry shod. When they crossed the Euphrates, they do it dry shod. When they cross the tongue of the Egyptian Sea, which has been utterly destroyed, they do it dry shod. They come to this highway right back to this exact same spot that Elijah left from. And then what? They cross it. But they don't cross it dry shod. Because this is this exact spot. By the way, this is the exact spot that Jesus baptized. This is the spot where they crossed in, which was a type of baptism, but they did it on dry ground. But these waters here, remember, after the earthquake in, is it Zechariah? No, I can't remember the chapter. The earthquake in Zechariah, when all the topography of the land is totally changed, the Dead Sea is lifted up. And it actually talks about the waters of that not being dead waters anymore. It talks about it being living waters. So here's Israel coming into the land through these living waters and into the land. Now that is amazing. It's like they're being baptized in a living sea. And from there, Elijah's going to take them up the valley of Achor for this door of hope, and they'll pass the monuments to Gog's destruction, and they'll go up to Jerusalem, and they'll finally, after 2,000 years, see Jesus as the King and the Messiah that they were so longing for. That's the work that Elijah's going to be involved in. And I think that's just absolutely remarkable that God has worked with him so much in his life to bring him to a point where he can lead Israel in that way. He wants them to save. He wants to save them. So that I think is pretty extraordinary, actually. and I think that's probably where we're going to leave it for now. But yeah, I've actually enjoyed looking at Elijah again. It's been a little while since I've done it. Yeah, I think that's it. I'll hand back over to you guys.
Well, thank you very much, Evan. It's a good reminder that our friends can really help us through some really tough times. And I guess now more than ever is a time when we need to sort of reach out to each other in the ways that we can. But it's also comforting to know that God is always there and that he is a great comfort as well. So, yes, thank you very much, Evan.